If you go to any big shopping mall, you know, and you want to park your car, there's all these cars parked, and then there's a long time nothing, and then you see one car just on the end, completely alone. That's Andy's car, because then nobody can bang into him with the doors.
Went to the test track, drove 430 or whatever, got back on the Autobahn, and I drove all the way to Molesworth. And this thing would do 204, and it felt really weird. Felt like you could open the door and just walk by the side of the car, because you've got yourself acclimatized to the speed. So that was the first experience I had.
Please don't do that there.
The truck's coming. And before the truck came, we spin it around the right way and we carry on going. So everything's perfect. Yeah,
plays with the car.
But it would have been even better were it not for the fact that there was a police car parked in the head and we went past him backwards on the rev limiter.
Right in the middle.
Heb je groeikapitaal nodig? Wij willen graag investeren in bedrijven met toekomst. En we hebben een budget tussen de 1 en de 5 miljoen euro. Een deel wordt gedaan door onszelf en een deel wordt gedaan door onze luisteraar. Je moet wel een goed verhaal hebben. Geen lulverhaal, want daar houden we niet van. Ga naar DutchDragons.nl en meld je aan. Jongens, goedendag. We hebben net besloten om toch in het Nederlands te doen.
Ja.
Oh ja?
We hebben hier twee hele bijzondere mensen aan tafel zitten. Heel bijzonder.
Two bijzondere people.
Ja.
Two very special people have on the table. And this the program, it calls Dragons, Dutch Dragons. Dutch, you know, Dragons Den in the UK? Mm. It's very famous.
It's very
program.
Famous in the UK, yeah?
It is. Yeah. It's big there. It yeah.
And we have a very popular podcast, which is widely spread in the Netherlands. So this is the first time we do it English and Netherlands.
Dutch. Cool. Dutch. Whatever.
And the special thing today is it our 100th podcast. So you are number 100.
Yeah.
So that's why
it's our
I invited you.
Hey, number that's 100. Why you have this beautiful cake. Nou, gefeliciteerd, mannen.
Ja,
wonderful.
Super. Hey, maar 100 podcasts, jongens. Ja. In nog geen anderhalf jaar.
Anderhalf jaar. That's it.
En wat een succesverhaal.
Ja. Maar 100 gasten. Dus jullie zijn de 101 guest in the house. Ja. Lekker, man.
Lekker man. Lekker man. Wow. Dus wie hebben we hier? Want we hebben een hele bijzondere gast. Jan. Ja.
Michel, jij moet even introduceren.
Andy Wallace, een hele bijzondere coureur. Heeft heel veel in zijn leven meegemaakt. En één ding voor mij iets heel speciaals. Zullen we daar ook een stukje van laten zien op een video. En Jan Lammers, ja, een van de bekendste racers die Nederland ooit heeft voortgebracht. En die hebben samen een verhaal ook. Daarom heb ik ze ook geprobeerd samen te krijgen. Dat viel niet mee.
Nee.
Jan, jij kan uitleggen. You can explain why
we have a story
you
together.
And Andy are linked together.
Yeah, we have lots of stories actually.
So, I'll do this bit in English.
The naughty ones. Yes, okay. Yeah, why not? Yeah.
No, Andy to me, Andy to me feels like a younger, very smart brother. So, because we have fantastic experiences together, too long to mention it in detail, but I think winning Le Mans together, that is something that
really?
Is our highlight. Yeah. And but also we won Daytona together. Andy went on to win even Sebring and which other one? Petit Le Mans, he also won. Yeah, so he basically won all the classic big
that's all
endurance
in US,
race.
Right?
Yeah. But he can speak more for himself, of course. Yeah.
But it's also, it was more than just what you said. I mean, all those things happened and it was like brothers in this case. But I was very new to this sports car racing scene. I'd been basically doing Formula 3, which is where we first met, which
he
is another story.
He beat me in Macau. Just,
anyway. But, I mean, obviously what you have when you try and do a 24-hour race, you've got three drivers in the car and you have to make sure that it's working for all three of you. It's no good just being one's happy and the other two are not.
Yeah.
So, and also because I was new to sports car racing, everything... Every single step of the way, Jan was basically holding my hand without physically holding my hand.
You have to trust each other, right? Trust each other.
Yeah, you have to trust, but also it's not an obvious thing. especially in the days before data in the cars. So there was an awful lot of talk between the three of us with Johnny. And then, obviously, famously, you came up with the comment, we're all sitting in the motorhome, and Jan said, right, this is what's going to happen. Gearbox is going to break, and we're not going to win. And then silence in the bus, dead silence. You say, well, and he said, but I've got a plan. And was it not for that plan, we would never have won the race. So it was having the knowledge that Jan had that obviously gearboxes were a weak point in those days. A lot of the cars were having gearbox issues. But Jan said, okay, this is what we need to do. And if we do this, we should be okay.
One question. Did you already have a lot of people around the race at that time? Coaches or people who looked enough? No, but it was just the three of you who were driving and deciding and everything.
Yes, on the driving side, there were no coaches
but
or
nobody
anything
said
like that.
You have to do this or that.
No.
Well, we had some medical support, of course, for the drivers. Physically, it was still very demanding. But we also had people for the electronics and for the brakes and for the gearbox. So everybody was allocated to their individual task. But what sort of came up in those days when
Andy those days were which year?
1988, and there is one unfortunately he's passed away way too early. It's Johnny Dumfries. He was our third driver. So there was no ranking.
How did he pass away?
He just got very ill. I think it's like 5 years ago now, maybe even six. Yeah. So Johnny Dumfries, a fantastic guy, great friend, great family guy, and just absolutely lovely. So with the three of us, we had our pep talk towards each other. And then, like Andy said, all of a sudden I realized, like, listen, guys, we're not going to win this race. We're going to lose it with the gearbox. Oh. And these days I do some presentations for businesses. And then I've actually learned in sports and in business that there's two ways, two different philosophies. One hand is like, okay, we're going to do this because you believe it, positive thinking, visualizing, we're going to do this and make it happen. Yep. That's one way. But strangely enough, with many football matches, you see like the leader of the table lose from the one on the bottom. Yeah. And that is simply because the one on the bottom goes in with the philosophy like, okay, we are going to lose today.
Yeah.
Unless. And that's also a way to approach things. Like, okay, we're going to sort of restore this thing, but it's not going to work. Unless.
Yeah.
And then when you put down your list, like, unless we do this the best and da-da-da-da-da, you know, it turned out to be later a philosophy that I think still works in business. Not in business because I'm poor, but
yeah,
in...
Why are you poor, Jan? Because you're a heavy racer, you're very successful. But in business,
well, you know, I
don't know. You're not poor, yeah.
No. I feel like I'm the wealthiest guy on earth without money.
Yes.
So because I've never been out on having things. I was more for doing things. So I always found a way to burn my money.
You have a lot of memories.
So I've earned a lot of money, but I've spent at least an equal amount, maybe even more. So
on what? Women?
No, unfortunately not. No, partly. No. But
no.
No, just you know, at some point I was okay, but then I decided to start my own Le Mans team. At some point we had three cars in the highest class and like 80 people walking around in Le Mans.
That costs a lot of money.
Yeah, so there was one point in 2006-07 that was really the depth, you know, the down point. I was negative like 3.2 million euro, negatief eigen vermogen.
Yeah.
So I brought that down to like 2.2, and then it took me between 2010, I closed the race team and everything, and between 2010 and 2014, I spent with a lot of patience and help and from good friends in my network, I managed not to go bankrupt.
Oh, wow.
But 2014...
That's entrepreneurship too, huh?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. But 2014...
What was your mistake with your team? What did you do wrong?
Well,
they say sometimes to me, if you want to be a millionaire, you need to be a billionaire and buy a race team, then you're going to be a millionaire. Is that true?
Well, I think Verstappen proved that that's not the case.
Okay, Max, it's,
right, so,
it's a different thing.
No, I think there is what I've learned from it is that in business and in sports, one of the very, very important things. I mean, look here in this Bugatti environment, passion and ambition is a very, very core value to start in your business. But if you don't control passion and ambition, it gets out of hand. And I think I was one of these guys that had the passion and the ambition, but not the financial quality or expertise or knowledge to control it. So yeah. My passion and my ambition went further than my finances could.
You had good partners?
And I had one partner. One partner in the beginning, but he was, a younger guy than me, and he had a young family. So I let him off the hook and said, like, well, you better get going. I'll solve this. Yep. I underestimated how long it took me. But
can you explain a little bit how do you start your career in racing?
That's a long time ago. That was on a what they call a skid control school, a slipschool in Holland. And that was just like a flat patch with, in those days, oil and water.
What year was that?
I was 12. I was 1968.
68. So. What car did you slip then with?
Well, that was a Simca. A little tiny road car. And it was 1973. When I was 16, I started my first race, won the first race and championship.
Yeah.
And then if I tell you the rest, then it goes dark here and you all fall asleep. So I made it from there.
Sorry to interrupt you. But, yeah.
Please.
All of the knowledge you got from the skid school, this knowledge has not gone to waste.
Not Canada, is it?
well, Canada was one of them. But I've driven with a lot of different teammates. And known a lot of racing drivers, of course, but the one with the best car control ever is this man
really?
Sitting here.
Yeah.
His car control is absolutely unbelievable.
Was it?
But there are so many stories, and I don't want to bore the whole podcast with these stories, but A couple of them I do remember. The one in Portugal, in Estoril, when you came into the paddock, you probably don't even remember this.
No.
So we were testing for Jaguar. All the trucks were lined up beautifully. All the team members' cars were parked along this little row of bushes in front, and there was one gap that you could just about fit one car in. So we come into the paddock. I think it was sprinkling with rain a little bit. We're doing about 120, 130 in the paddock. And Jan says, watch this. And I learned in the end, whenever he says, watch this, afterwards something really amazing is going to happen. So he I didn't even know what you did. I was in the passenger seat, and he started off with the handbrake, and then I could see the gap, and I was like, no way, we're going in this gap. And we came round and straight in the gap, and it was equidistant to the two other cars. You could open the doors. It was perfect. And I thought, well, that was just luck. I said, I bet you can't do that again.
Again.
Yeah. It was back out. Only this time he comes in another 20 Ks faster. Again, perfect. So that's that one. The Canadian one. This one, still, I don't know how we didn't go to jail. But basically, you know the track in Canada? It's the...
Island, yeah.
Yeah, on the island. And there's a lot of police everywhere normally, and you have to behave yourself, which we were doing. But we're going along. I think it was a Honda Civic. Four-door Honda Civic with automatic transmission. And again, it had been raining a little bit. And we're going, and it's a two-way road. So we're on the right side. And in the distance is a big truck coming. And Jan said, watch this, obviously. What else would he say? And he flipped it round backwards, shoved it into reverse. And we're now on the rev limiter in reverse. The truck's coming. And before the truck came, we spin it around the right way and we carry on going. So everything's perfect. Yeah,
he plays with the car.
But it would have been even better were it not for the fact that there was a police car parked in the hedge and we went past him backwards on the rev limiter.
Right in the middle of...
Were you nervous or not?
He was laughing on the floor. I thought, well, it wasn't that funny. And then he tried to explain. I said, it wasn't that funny. And he goes... He tried to tell me that I did the whole exercise just in front of a police car.
Yeah. Backwards past the police car on the rev limiter. So,
but we got police car
comes. You wave to them and then...
No. So Jan looks as, oh, shit. Okay, don't worry, I can lose them. So we go. And we lost them, mostly, until we get into Montreal. And then the traffic got a little bit thicker and then it just wasn't worth doing something really stupid. So we just pulled over onto the hard shoulder And then the guy gets out of the car and he's not best pleased and he's walking towards the car and there's four of us in the car. You remember? It was me.
I'm going to be arrested and I'm going after you.
Okay, this is for you.
It's not live.
No, there is a disclaimer here. None of this actually happened. It was just a dream I had and I'm just relaying the dream. It never happened. Okay, so it's myself, David Jones, Jan. We won to Daytona's together. The 24 hours. And then Davy Jones's lawyer was in the car, in the back. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah. The lawyer.
The lawyer, yeah.
He's always with.
Apparently, yeah. So the cop walks along, window down, and then so license registration, and he takes it, and he's really not best pleased. And he goes back to the car, police car, and he's checking us all out. And then we're all having a conversation in the car. So, you're a lawyer. What's going to happen next then? Well, if this was America, we're going to jail. It's Canada. Sure, yeah. We're probably still going to jail. Might be slightly luckier. Anyway, so this is 25 minutes or more goes past, and then the guy comes back. Yes, you know, sitting in the car, puts the window down, and Jan's like, you were saying, like, what can I say? What can I say? Shut up. I've got it. So guy comes up, window goes down. The guy goes, so what was that then? And then Jan says, oh, are you allowed to swear on a podcast?
Yeah, you can.
He says, look, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry, officer. I can't lie to you. We were just fucking about. He's talking to the guy. And the guy goes, right. Don't you ever, ever, ever do that again. And he gave him his license back.
Like, no, made it. That's really amazing.
And Jan,
yeah.
And Jan, this talent you have, huh? Did you give it to your kids?
Well, I think it's you know, there it's you yeah. see it in soccer. There's these guys that end up on the city square doing all these tricks with the balls, you know, but you don't end up in the first
not
team.
Not with a car, Jan.
Yeah, but so you can do tips, you know, lots of tricks and all that, but that doesn't necessarily make you a very quick racing driver. It gives you a little bit of, you know, extra security that if things get rough, you get yourself out of situation, but I don't think you needed to be a quick racing driver. Okay. So I grew up in that. Until I was 16, I barely knew how to drive straight on. But but anyway, so my kids grew up differently, particularly the youngest. We tried to build a career for him and tried to get him
Let's
into
Formula
1. Let's
speak about it later because it's interesting.
Sure.
There's coming a new Max Verstappen. Very
soon. Yeah, nice.
His son or not?
We go
not
for it.
Yet. Yeah, his son nice speak about it yet. No. Andy, how did you start your career? But
right, again, how long's the podcast?
You know, the reason why Andy is here, that he made a speed record with a Bugatti nearly 500 kilometers an hour. We'll speak about it later. And this one.
Really?
This car.
This one.
You did it.
Yeah. Your head was in that helmet.
Right there is your helmet.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's right.
I collected everything.
Nice one.
But I thought it was 418 or it's 500?
490.4837.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
There was no vibration or anything like that. But the two biggest problems you got is taking off or getting a puncture. And if it was a real one, would make you take off.
Okay.
So you have to do weeks and weeks of testing, building up, and checking how much load's on the front and the back. And then each
There's extra lead in the car to balance it? Or
you can only, because it was a production car record, you can only use what the standard car has.
Okay.
So the standard car has already got hydraulic flaps in the front diffuser, plus wing angle and ride height, mm-hmm. which is changeable. But you build up in 10 or 20 kilometer increments and then hold that speed for 10 or 15 seconds and you measure the load. So the last data point is 450. That's the last one you can do because you can't hold it for that long before you run out of road. So at 450 kilometers an hour, and by the way, any car ever built, if you make it go fast enough, it would fly.
Yeah.
It's normal.
Like those speedboats you see on the water. Or
Well, every car, it's just normally you don't have enough power to get to that point. So at 450, it's got something like 186 kilos of lift at the front and 150 of downforce on the back.
Yeah.
So you can, and it's an exponential growth. So you can then calculate, okay, it'll be good till 500 and something before it takes off. So you've got that, but it also the tire situation. So you're spinning the tires so fast. Michelin put them on the rig to test how you know, how strong they are. Yep. But it's not a case of a tire exploding at a certain point. It's a length of time above a critical speed. So all of the road car Bugattis have got a speed limiter at either 420 or 440, depending on the model.
That much, okay.
Yeah, so the critical speed is something like 470. So when you cross over 470, the amount of time that you can spend above it before you have a tyre failure is finite. It's in seconds, yeah. Rather than minutes or hours. So you've got to get to that critical speed, go up to your Vmax and get back down below before you've spent too much time above the critical speed. Yeah. So this is the thing with the tyre. And then at that speed, you've got a 7,000 kilo tearing force this way, if the wheel's going around this way. So if you imagine, take the wheel out of the tyre or the tyre off the rim, put a chain through that, and you're picking up 3.5 Chiron. That's the tearing force on the tyre.
That's it.
Incredible. It's incredible.
And you really needed the money to do this? I've had
the world speed record in Jaguar XJ220.
This was
McLaren
all about,
F1.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, and then Bugatti.
How much was it?
The world speed, record?
In the Bugatti?
Yeah.
No, in the XJ220.
Yeah. XJ220, I think, was 349. Then the McLaren was 387.
There's two fingers in the nose, right?
And this one's 490. But I wasn't actually heading out to do any of those. I was just kind of stood in the right place at the wrong time or the other way around. And they say, okay, can you just drive that car quickly? And I ended up being in that
Would you do it again? Because it's high risk, right?
It is.
If you make a mistake of this, you're dead.
Well, the thing is, I think the mistake from the driving side, there isn't so much you can do unless you freak out and panic and do something wrong, but it's mostly the car is doing it for you, of course. The easiest part of the job is probably the driver, but you're also along for the ride when it does go wrong. So when I was talking to you about the tyres, if you had a rear tyre failure, just the change in rake angle, you fly.
Yeah.
So you're doing almost 500 kilometres and you're flying. So that's not going to be a good result in the end.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that you can do to try and ensure that you get rid of most of the risk, but the risk still exists.
What do you wear? Diapers, of course, but more. Do you have a suit that's non-flammable?
You have a normal race suit, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that for Andy, as a driver, what you need is a very, very responsible and accurate driver.
Okay.
No, not balls, because that will get you hurt.
Okay.
You know, you don't need an indifferent driver like, oh, yeah, this is okay. So you don't need a cool macho guy.
Serious.
You need somebody that is very sensitive.
That's why they chose me, right?
No, but you...
You need
somebody who's very sensible and accurate, who can sort of like see that at some speed that something needs extra attention, and then you get to that next level. And also the teamwork that you need with your suppliers and your partners. Because you sit there, but you're totally relying on Michelin, in this case, doing a good job. Because if the tire goes, basically you go. There's no prayer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he would have looked a lot different.
How long did it took to get the speed of 490?
In terms of seconds?
Yeah.
A day extra, miles?
No, we did a couple of weeks of testing.
Extra speed,
In fact, the first thing they did was Bugatti said, right, you're going to need to get used to doing the speed because it's not a normal speed. At the time, the Chiron was limited to 420, so the 300 plus is limited to 440. So I'd only ever been 420. So the first thing they said to me over a weekend in Erlesine at the VW test track, we're taking the limiter off a standard Chiron, go and get used to it. And I guess the standard car could probably do 430, 435. The difference between 420 and 430 is massive.
No.
It's absolutely massive. It's crazy to try to understand how and why that is. But I think probably something that you would be familiar with, if you go in a car and you're doing, say, 200 kilometers an hour, it's on the Autobahn, it's quite fast, actually. But if you go 250, it's a huge difference.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a lot faster than 200, even though it's only 50 kilometers more.
Yep.
But going back to the tyre, so there is a rig in the US, I think it's in South Carolina, for Michelin's rig, and it's a big drum that comes out of the wall, and they put the tyre on this drum, and you can put the load on, you can put the speed on, and you can put camber on and off, toe on and off, pressure up and down to find out where the failure is on it. And what you're looking for is you're looking for a failure in the same place every time. Otherwise, if it's random, you don't know what you've got.
Yeah.
When they came away from the testing, this was the standard Chiron tire, they said, yes, it can do 500, but we're not happy. So they said, okay, so what's the solution? Well, we have to build a new tire for your record, but it's no good. You can't do the record on a one-off tire. So then they made that tire homologated, and that's the tire that comes on the 300 plus. It's got BG2 written on the side.
Yep.
So they had to build this special tire for us to do that. And then, of course, it became the standard tire. And one of the things they, if you increase the weight of the tire to make it stronger, you create a bigger problem because there's more rotating force and more tearing force. So they wanted the tire to be the same size and weight, but not, but stronger. So there's these metal strands that go around the tire radially before the last layer of rubber goes on. They went back to the standard carcass, and then they chose a different material to go radially around the tire before they put the top layer of rubber on.
I think it's now presenting or not?
Oh, yeah, it is. That's coming now.
Tell us something about
well,
it.
Well, all of the filming that you see where you're getting close to the car is not at that speed. But, yeah, this is 490.
And where was it? Where was it taken?
Yes, 304 miles an hour, if you're looking at the miles. But all of the... That's Riz. But the stuff on the outside was at a lot lower speed because we couldn't find something quick enough.
Quick,
yeah, it's and it's moving left and right. You can see the white lines going across and coming back. And
how do you feel then?
Were you scared or not?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Oh, there it goes.
Yeah.
If people from Mars see this, I think they think we're crazy, right?
Wow. Daar gaat ie.
490, yeah.
En dan?
Handremmetje.
Wat is handrem in het Engels?
Handbrake.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that was very
fantastic.
Nice. That is nice.
So, Andy, how did you start your career?
So,
because this is one of the highlights.
Yeah. If I one little more thing about this, did you ever have? I had this when I went to Le Mans. Sometimes a quick track, the first lap, I always had to calibrate my senses. I could be on the first time on the straight, and then my brain tells me like, okay, I don't have to brake before 300, but my senses told me to slow down, and then you keep your foot in there, and then it is a motion sickness thing. Almost feels like you're car sick, and then once you had like almost like a reset, and then I was fine. Did you ever have that?
I did, and because we spent during the actual week that we did the record, we did 1,000 kilometers above 400. So the more you do it,
The first time after breakfast, for instance, like, go bang.
Oh no, when you first go out,
always okay.
Well, normally, like going 400 is just wrong. Everything's wrong about it. But you do it over and over and over and over, and you get acclimatized to it. In the end, as we got close to the record, I was actually even switching my brain off until it went past 400. That thing on the window that was giving you the speed, the readout, you're just going, yeah. And as soon as you see 400, okay, now concentrate. And you do that bit after. It's really an odd, a really odd thing. But they resurface half of the track, but unfortunately only the half where you're accelerating, not the bit where you do Vmax. And the join, if you go over in a normal road car, you could just feel a bump. But in this... It was leaving the ground, and it was like 470, and it was just jumping over the bump. And I kept saying to them, car's a little bit unstable over the jump. And they're over the jump. They go, whoa, what do you mean over the jump? I said, you know, there's a jump on the... No, there's no jump. And they're looking through all the data. Shit, it's off the ground. It's a jump. And so on the actual run that we did, the very last run, which was the 490, I came off the banking because there's a speed limit on the banking. So... But you need to get going as soon as you can so you don't run out of space the other end. I came off the banking about, I don't know, 10 or 15 quicker than before. And I'd already had a chat with the Michelin guys because they were saying, don't go over 240. And I said, look, if I go 200 or even 180 around the banking until the very last bit of the banking and then go, is that going to be okay? And they went, So no. I just thought, okay, I'll do it. And so I came off a lot quicker.
Why not 500? Is that well, no, but you, really, the last 10?
You basically, to go an extra 1 or 2 kilometers an hour, you need a whole load more power.
Yeah.
But also you're running out of space. So the straight's 8.8 kilometers long.
So this is really max.
Yeah, but you need 2 kilometers to slow down.
Two
kilometers, yeah. So you've only got the 6.8 or whatever. So then once you get going, you have to decide when to lift off. This is the thing. You don't know. You've never been that fast before. Yeah. So it's no good putting two cones by the side of the road, because at 140 meters per second, they're gone. You can't even see them. So when I got back after doing the run, and it pretty much maxed out, it was still climbing. It would have gone maybe 2 or 3 more if there was more space.
That's it.
But not 500, I don't think. I get back, and of course, the engineers look at all the data and excuse me, and they say, huh, yes. You lifted 90 meters too early. You
know, no.
Something. So I said, well, how much is that in time? He's like, oh, no, like 0.55 of a second. Well, I'm sorry. Do you want me to go and do it again?
I went, no, after 10.
Don't do it again.
No.
But so how you became a test driver for Bugatti? I mean, what did you do in your life? Why are you so famous?
Right, okay.
In the UK, you are a hero.
Well, yeah, thanks to this guy.
Yeah.
That's for sure. But But my dad was really keen on motor racing. He used to take me to the track to watch. I think he wanted to do it, but he didn't have any money. And then I was just hanging onto the fence, a bit like you were with the skid school. And I just thought, this is something I really want to do. So for my 15th birthday, it was something like 30 euros for a lesson at the Jim Russell School. And all it was going up and down the straight, changing gear, braking, and doing this at age 15. And then at the end of that, he said, okay, that was your birthday present. If you want to do the rest of the course, you need to go and find yourself, I was still at school, obviously, but go and find, you know, washing up jobs and sweeping and delivering and all the rest of it. And you could do the course in a week or 2 weeks, the whole course. So by doing it my way with the delivering the newspapers and all the rest of it, it took 2 years and 2 months to do a week's course, you know, one lesson every so-and-so, you know. Anyway, at the end of it all, That was great. Everything went great. But what's your next plan? Okay, I need to buy a race car. So I
borrow. You can borrow it.
Well, buy. No.
I'll buy.
I had to buy one.
I'll buy
my own car, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'd already identified that I couldn't buy a new one. So there was a series for cars built, Formula Ford cars, before 1974. And it's called pre-74 Formula Ford. So I'd identified which are the front-running cars in that series. It was Hawkdale 11 I decided I'd like to buy. And there was a guy in Scotland, quite far from where I was living, who had one for sale.
What did he do with it in Scotland? Why
well,
was
he was racing
there?
It, but he just had to come,
really racing.
He had to come to civilization, I guess, every single time.
Okay, yeah.
Actually, any Scottish people watching this is going to be really annoyed by that.
That's,
I'm a quarter
English
Scottish,
humor,
so I can say that. So I went to the bank, and this was in the days when you had a bank manager. And I made an appointment, and it's okay, what do you want? Sat down, shut the door. I said, I'd like to borrow some money to buy a racing car. And then he just looked at me, he's like, what? I said, yeah, just don't worry, I'm going to be world champion. You'll get the money back. He went, go. Didn't even talk to me. So I had this brilliant idea, because I needed to find the money.
Yeah.
I went to a second-hand car sales place, and I bought a second-hand, it was a Ford Escort, a second-hand car on payments. And then took the car away. Cost me nothing. And the following day, I sold it. There was nothing to stop you doing that in those days. There's no computers.
That's a business model.
Yeah.
Okay. So why not then?
Well,
then?
Of course, I continued to pay the payments, and nobody knew anything about it. But that was, I got the money.
You got the papers, and you could sell it.
You could sell it. Like
we could both get arrested today.
you would. So this guy in Scotland, and so I called him up, and okay, let's meet halfway. Well, halfway was it's probably about 6-hour drive to get to Scotland, and halfway was near Alton Park. Mm. There's a service area called Sandbach Services. He said, yeah, okay, let's meet there. So he's got one of those old coaches that people used to use in those days. You remember they converted them, put the car in the back.
Oh, I started.
So,
the bus.
I drove up there, and there's this bus sitting in there, and I knocked on the window. Ah, hello. Right. Well, the car's in the back. So he opens the doors, gets the car out, and there's this lovely Formula Ford car. You know, it's, I guess, 7 years old or something like that, 7 or 8 years old. And he wanted So in euros, probably be 1,500 euros. That was it for the car.
Wow.
So I'm looking at it. It looks great. And he said, well, what are you taking for a drive? I said, okay. So I jump in the car and I'm doing laps of this Sandbach services in a Formula Ford car. I mean, you would be locked like away station. Forever.
Yeah.
It's like a, yeah.
Nice.
And I did it. It came back and I said, yeah, it's great. So anyway, I got up really early to get there and I probably looked a little bit straggly.
How old you was then?
So that was 1979. I was 18. Yeah. And I had cash. So I was counting it out. In Scotland, they're very well known to hold on to their money.
Holland too.
Oh, yeah?
That's Scrooge.
The Scottish and the Dutch have the same image.
There you go. Oh, yeah? So anyway, I counted it out and the last 10 landed on the table. And then he was like, okay, so, oh, for goodness sake, buy yourself some breakfast or something. Because I looked like I hadn't eaten for a year. And he gave me the 10 back and I did that. And
nice.
I got the car home and then...
You drove it home?
No, I bought a trailer actually from Jonathan Palmer, and it was a trailer with wheels from the mini car, right? Yeah. Nobody does that, and I realised why. So to get back from there to home, I already had 4 punctures. They're rubbish as a trailer tyre, apparently. Anyway, so I got it back. I stripped the car down with any of the knowledge that I had, and you know, there's no YouTube in those days. Put it all back together. Booked a day at Silverstone. It was the 31st of August, 1979. I remember it well because something bad happened. So I already knew what front row time was for qualifying. So I was there with my dad, my brother, and a couple of friends doing the stuff in the pit lane. It was an open test day. I went round and round and round and round. I did a time which would easily have been front row of the grid. Came in, made an adjustment, went back out again. Car's even faster. So I was going, it was great. Then I'm coming down the club straight. This was the old short circuit at Silverstone. It's about probably a 1.2 kilometre straight, I would say. And then at the end, you've got a corner which is probably 110 degrees. It's the final corner before the start line. So I'm going down the straight. Another car comes, but this is on slicks, the car that's coming. It was a clubman's car. Formula Ford had treaded tyres. He pulls out, passes me, pulls back in. We get to the braking area. I'm right behind him.
Shit.
Turn in, and he spins.
Oh.
Now, the thing is, I'd spun the car before, but on treaded tyres, they spin quite far. A slick car spins and stops. So as he was spinning, I thought, I'll go inside. And expecting him to go backwards. Well, he stopped so quickly, I couldn't. And my left front wheel hit his right front wheel. Bang.
Take off.
Over.
Three
barrel rolls.
And that upside was your down. First race.
First test day. The first time I ever driven it. So now it's on the roll hoop, finally after 3 barrel rolls. Guess where it landed? Pole position. Absolutely perfectly. In pole position.
You have that photo?
Upside down. Well, there were no cameras in those days. Well, phone cameras anyway.
No.
So now there's fuel pouring all over me. And I'm upside down, and there was lots of sparks involved.
I thought,
need to go out. You know, I don't want to say it. So I'm trying to get out, and I'm kicking, and I cannot get out. And the reason I can't get out, I still got the seatbelts on, but I hadn't realised that at the time. And this big hand came underneath, and it was the legendary Silverstone Sid. Do you remember?
Yeah.
And he just undid the belt. Out I come, boff, stand there, don't move. Cars are still coming. There's yellow flags. Nobody's paying any attention to the yellow flags.
Yeah.
And that was my very, very first test day. So that was almost back to zero.
And did you ever drove, where did you, what was your first big success?
So I'll try and keep it brief. So I crashed a couple of times, won the fourth race, then won the championship, 1980. Okay. So that was all good. Then Formula 4 2000, Formula 3 had a really good season, won the British F3 Championship. And then Macau was a really, really big race where you had not just the Formula 3 people.
Macau is like in those days, it's like the world championship of Formula 3.
Oh, really?
So the Formula 3 people from Japan or Asia, if you like, and Italy and France and
you were
wherever.
Also there, Jan?
I was there, but I was already at Jaguar, I think. So some drivers just got invited, like Jean Alesi and Arnoux and, you know, Johansson for Ferrari.
F1, F2,
yeah,
endurance.
Everything. But anyway, Andy was there as the British Formula 3 Championship.
Which gives me an advantage over Jan because I've been doing Formula 3 that year and you were just a guest driver in a car you're not familiar with. But we had a good... battle, and it's run over two races. And that,
there you became friends.
You met
well,
each other.
Not because of that, but the, Jan was leading, and I'm chasing him everywhere, and I'm fully aware, you know, it's very difficult to pass, except for the Lisboa corner at the end of the straight. That's the only place you can really do it without coming together. Jan knows this too. So I'm all over him like a rash, down the straight, last lap. And this is my only chance. And Jan's looking in the mirror. And now with the car control, I know he has, anybody else would have crashed. But he broke so late for the corner. And the car was a little bit unstable at the back. And I think the left rear just touched the white line and the car started to go around. But with Jan's car control, he managed to catch it. And he's coming into the corner, sort of out of control, but in control, except he's going to run out of road because the apex is a barrier and he's going to hit the barrier head on. So I see my chance. This all happens in a split second. I see my chance, dive down the inside, clack, clack, clack on the wheels, push him straight and pass him. And now we're first and second.
First and second
the other way
yeah.
around.
Yeah. Because the way I experienced it is that I'm going into this last lap. You can't overtake in Macau. So I thought like, okay, this race is in the bag. One more lap. And I thought he's going to consolidate and think, okay, I can't overtake anymore. And I thought I take advantage of that thing. So I thought one more qualifying lap, break a bit later and just even go absolutely 105%. But then, like Andy says, I hit the white line. And it's kind of him to say that I was in control, but I wasn't. Because I was either going to spin or hit the tires. And I probably was on my way to spinning. But then Andy came and he set me sort of straight. But at the same time, he passed me on the inside. So then that was it. So then we were first and second. But like I always say, like, you know, in the end, I still won. Because, you know, my dear friend won, so then you win. So when we're together, we can say we won Macau,
we won,
but he needs to be there.
You had a very good career, you. You lost your money with your team. Mm. What happened with you? You made a lot of money with racing?
Well, it was going well.
This is a Dragon's Den. This is also speaking of
He's a very sensible man with money, so he doesn't waste it.
The problem is that Formula 2 was a bit cloudy. In those days, it went into Formula 3000. It didn't really exist very well. And most people went F3, F1. So after doing that, winning Macau and the British F3, I went and knocked on all the doors, F1 teams. Hello, blah, blah. Yeah, we know who you are.
Benetton, right?
I did test drive the Benetton, at the end of 86. But two teams, Arrows and Tyrrell, offered me a drive for the following year for 87.
In the Formula 1?
In Formula 1. But I just needed to come back with $600,000. Well, I was completely broke.
You pay that for a Friday test these days, yeah? At least 800,000, I think.
Oh, really?
So it couldn't happen.
Hey.
Yeah.
So, so in the end, because that was never going to work, had we not had this and sort of got friendly on the podium and all the rest of it, Jan put in a good word for me at Jaguar. And then I was invited to Paul Ricard to do an audition, basically.
So you're... Formula 1 career never happened.
I was test driver for Leighton House, March, and then Leighton House for 2 years, 1991. But
never official.
Never raced.
And is that because you have not enough? I mean, what's happening now with Max is amazing. That's one of a kind.
Yeah,
and
he is.
I sponsored his father, and I had to pay even Minardi a lot of money to let yours drive in Minardi. But Max is making millions.
Yeah.
So
unfortunately, unless you make it in Formula 1, you're not going to make millions in any of the other racing, really.
It costs money always.
No, it doesn't always cost money. No, because eventually you drive with a factory team and you'll be paid, but you're not paid millions. That's the problem.
You know, it's a little bit like if you're a very talented golf player or tennis player, then it's always a question, where do you go with that talent? Some end up, you know, just being a teacher, and others end up being
a teacher.
And the other one goes to win Wimbledon or anything close to that. Yeah. So it's always, are you sensible and go like, okay, I just build a career as a teacher, or do you really try to go for the top?
And a bit of luck,
And then it's just like a high risk thing. And you know, in business, you know, the bigger the risk, the bigger the award. But you know, most of them don't make it and are never to be seen because they do God knows what.
Hey, and Jen, you made it to the Formula One. How did this happen?
Yeah, well, you know, I won the European Formula 3 Championship, still as the only Dutchman, I'm proud to say. Oh, cool. But that was in 78. And then in 79, I got an offer to go to Shadow Formula One. That was like a back market team. You know, there was a small private bad team, but you didn't
like
get
Minardi.
Yeah, probably even worse. much worse. But in those days, when you had a chance to do Formula One, you had to take it because you probably wouldn't get it again. Yeah. Alan Prost, he won the European Championship the year after me in Formula 3. And he had a much more sensible route. He went to McLaren with some Marlboro money behind him. France was a bigger market. So, I went to Shadow. It was a tough year, but still, I always thought like, well, it's good to just learn and feel the ropes. And then a year later, you perform. But it doesn't work like that because if you're not in a good environment and if you are not with a good team, you don't learn anything. You learn it the wrong way.
And what about your son? Because I heard some beautiful stories about from Michel.
Yeah, well,
from Michel, it's also in the press.
Yeah,
yeah. So you know, we're doing well.
Are we doing well, or you are doing top?
Well, I think we're top.
Are you giving him the same chance as you had, or you give him
better chance as
Max had?
Yeah, because
this is so difficult. There are more astronauts than Formula One drivers.
Probably, yeah. But
I mean, astronaut.
No, but you know, in my days, in after 79, in 1980, my best was qualifying fourth. You know, so there was a record.
And then what happened after the fourth qualifying?
Well, long story. I won't bore you with that. But then for 34 years, I had that record for the highest qualifying Dutch Formula One
Dutch
driver.
People, yeah.
Then Max came and that all went to pieces. But then, you know, I have three wonderful kids, Soumaya Rayan, that's my daughter and my oldest son from my marriage, 31 now and 28. Mm-hmm. The marriage didn't hold up, unfortunately, but the relationship with the kids, fantastic. Right. Everybody knows that has kids that if you mention one, you have to mention the other one. So, but anyway, then the youngest, you know, from my later generation with Mariska already for like 25 years now, that's René. He's 17 now. He had a great career, almost as good as you can have it in karting. So we did
what
karting.
What did he do in karting?
Well, all the way, the highest level,
really?
The FIA OK Senior Championship. And he won the European Championship. He won the World Championship almost. He got sort of a little bit in trouble at the start, so he started as 12th.
Yeah.
He was second, but he dropped back to
12th. So he's in the picture, really in the picture now.
Yeah, but then he still he finished second in the World Championship by 1800, so he still came back through the field. But he was number one on the world ranking of the FIA at that time. Then we went to Formula 4. He got scouted by Ferrari. He won the European scouting competition and also the world finals he won. But then 1 week he learned that he won the competition. And 1 week later, the guy who was there in control of the junior academy at Ferrari, after 8 years, he got fired. So then all of a sudden, we were just up in the air.
It's also politics.
So it was and a little bit of luck.
No, it was, yeah.
A little bit of luck.
It was
money
tough.
And politics.
Well, we got rescued by MP Motorsport, Henk de Jong. You know, fantastic team, very high morale, fantastic people. So so we really got lured into the car racing a little bit quicker than we had planned to. So if, for instance, you compare it with Tom Coronel or Rocco Coronel, he's racing Formula 4 now in his first year, but he's already driving cars for 3-4 years. So they're much better prepared. Good job to them. And he's doing well on the track.
How old is he?
He's turning 16 this year.
Okay, 16. Oh, a year difference.
Yeah.
These fathers are dreaming about Max.
Yeah. Well, yeah, not at all. Because Max is just once in a lifetime. So we're not trying to be Max. He doesn't have to beat Max. It's a different generation. If and by the time he reaches Formula One, maybe if Max does an Alonso and comes back, he might race him. Yeah. But no, I think that from his generation, he is as good, and I'm happy to take on any junior driver in any class of his age, and he is as good or maybe slightly better because, you know, some drivers are good in different areas, you know. So, but he's a good all-rounder. He's quick. He's a good racer. For sure, he has a lot to learn, but he will.
Has a father who knows everything.
Yeah, but you know, I am the genius out of the bottle because I am turning 70 this year. And
70?
Yeah, so.
Sounds good, eh?
Shit.
Did you, see yourself in the mirror?
There's a big age difference. So whatever I know or whatever I am capable of.
He's so kind for me always, sorry.
No, but whatever I know or are capable of is not relevant anymore. So there's lots of good people around him. But
okay. So you're not there every week screaming next to the circuit?
No, that doesn't work because then the team will put you just on the parking place. So no. I leave it to the guys that are
given different education as Max had from yours.
Yeah, but also different times because the way that Max and Jos did it in those days, that's how everybody does it now. Because, you know, we drive and simulator training. It's just no end to it. We are sort of like in a sim trainer. We are at Verstappen.com. So in one way, the expertise of Max is somewhere in the system. But theoretically, he should be ready for Formula One in 2 or 3 years, or even practically.
So that's the route, 2 or 3 years Formula One.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, it's all funding depending and success depending.
How much do you need to come in?
Sorry, what?
How much do you need to come in to the Formula One?
I think we need another 3 million to make it to Formula One. So for the next...
Another 3 million to make it to Formula One, and then the real game is starting.
Okay. Yeah.
And I had my thing.
You had your lessons?
Yeah.
Yes, and I made a mistake with Max. So, you know, I'm out.
Yeah. No, so you know, we need somebody with a lot of money and a boring life. You know, your life is too your life is too exciting, so you don't need that. But still, you know, I'm confident that we will go a long way, but like you say, you also need that little bit of luck.
Yeah.
And your personality and your character changes as you grow, and that either gets better and better and better or whatever. We don't know, but
If you would do it again in your life, you would do the same
racing. Andy.
Yeah, what you did. You would.
I think also when both of us started, it was possible to make some success without a big pot of money to start with. Mm. Now you can't. You need the pot of money as well as being okay at driving. I've had a fantastic time racing for sure, and also the story I told you about the, you know, $600,000 and you can drive the car next year. Julian Bailey actually took the Tyrrell drive, and he sold everything he had and he borrowed money from everyone and he did it and he paid the money and he drove the car, and the car wasn't very good that year.
Yeah,
so it was in and out, gone, and it's all finished. Also, I did I tested the Benetton BMW at Donington after Macau in '86, and then I was the test driver for a couple of years. I think it's not just a case of having the money. If I was really good enough to have gone to the very top of F1, somebody would have seen that when I drove the Benetton and all the March and the later now. So it's not, you know, you can't just say,
it's not only the money. It's
not only the money. You've got to be good. And I obviously wasn't good enough. Somebody would have said, look, this guy's amazing. Let's try him.
Yeah.
And nobody
did. Same for me. I mean, obviously, when you make it, you're good. When you're good enough, you'll make it. If you don't make it, somewhere down the line, you've been lacking something. Mm-hmm. And very important, relevant thing at the moment in racing and in any sport probably, but more here, it's a material sport, so you need money. As soon as you leave the pit lane, you start burning fuel and rubber and brakes. You need the track rent and everything. But what is very important these days is your online visibility. If you don't exist online, you don't exist.
Instagram, Facebook,
so
whatever.
So if René would be 1/10 quicker than any other driver, but the other driver has 1 million followers, he will get the job probably.
It's like that.
Yeah. Because that's also something that's important, and we're working on that.
New things to.
Yeah, and then as a sportsman, you also have to be a little bit of an entertainer, because you know you have to be online with your little, movies and things, and that's a thing that I don't particularly like, because lots of drivers.
Well, you can learn a lot from David Coulthard.
Yeah, that's still different. It's still different. It's YouTube, it's TikTok, it is Instagram and Facebook, and you have to just do your thing.
Be there every day.
Yeah, and sometimes it's too forced, because all of a sudden you see all the drivers doing that.
Yeah.
And then you have to, as a personality, René is quite introvert, and he's not a clown who goes and does, so he's focused on the racing. He likes that, and all the other things around it is something that he really has to put himself to. So, where is the line where you stay, loyal to your own character and focus on the quality as a driver, and where do you, go and become that little entertainer? So it's an extra quality that would help if you have that.
Even if he will not successful in Formula One, he can make his money or his life with testing and racing. And
you do see that. He's already coaching other drivers online now. Sometimes he's helping. And,
so there
and,
is a, it's...
Yeah, yeah, I mean, yeah.
To
yeah.
be a Formula One driver is a dream. Mm-hmm. But except that dream, there is a future.
Absolutely.
For, racing.
You can go like Formula E or something else, and there are good wages to be earned as a driver. So there is a way out. Yeah.
What's your most favorite racer? If you look,
racing driver,
yeah.
Oh, absolutely, Max. Because I like him. He's the most complete driver. He's very genuine. He has great loyalty, great character. And that's more judging from the people that I've spoke that work with him.
Okay.
And he's very honest. And if you get a ride in his plane and you don't behave to the personnel on the plane, you're out for the next time.
That's nice.
He's just a very, very, and that's a great compliment to his dad, Jos, and his mother, Sophie.
And that, his mother, that, yes. Sophie,
yeah,
yes.
So,
mother side.
She's amazing. Yeah.
Andy, your most favorite racer?
Lewis Hamilton, because he's British.
No, not at all. What I was going to say was, you have to hand it to Max. He has been so successful, he never makes mistakes. Wow. How can you be that fast and that close to the limit and don't make a mistake? And he's also driven cars which were very, very difficult to drive, as you can see from everybody they put in as a teammate.
Bizarre,
The cars quite often are, and cars when they're fast, they are very edgy, but that car looks almost impossible to drive sometimes, and he'll drag a result from it. I mean, that's a true champion.
Yeah.
It's difficult, with different years, it's difficult. In the past, I would say Alonso, I would say Raikkonen, those kind of people, they were fantastic drivers.
Yeah.
But nobody really stood out as far as Max does. I don't know.
Very nice things to end.
Yeah.
Yeah, one question. If you were like you, do you drive also on the normal road as fast as you can, or how does that work?
Do you know what? I don't.
But if you're a boxer, you don't fight in the street.
No,
you fight
exactly.
In the ring.
I don't drive fast on the road. This is the crazy thing.
If you go to any big shopping mall, you want to park your car, there's all these cars parked, and then there's a long time nothing, and then you see one car just on the end, completely alone. That's Andy's car, because then nobody can bang into him with the doors. I mean, I'm starting to do that now, but that's how...
He's very safe.
Yes, very safe.
And actually, to be honest, it's going back to the story of this again, that first weekend where they gave me a share on with the speed limiter off, I had to do some customer drives from Molsheim. And from the test track to Molsheim is about 5.5 hours.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is unrestricted.
You can do it in
Autobahn. Yeah, so and I had I had a Polo, a VW Polo that I rented. Went to the test track, drove 430 or whatever, got back on the Autobahn, and I drove all the way to Molsheim. This thing would do 204, and it felt really weird. I was doing, got it to 204, and it felt like you could open the door and just walk by the side of the car because you've got yourself acclimatized to the speed. So that was the first experience I had.
Please don't do that there.
No.
Open up the door if you've ever spoken to
you see that in Indianapolis often. People come into the pit, and particularly the ones that come in the beginning, you drive at close to 350, 400, and then you come in the pit, and when you still do 200, it feels like 60 kilometers. You want to stop in.
So your brain is
in front of your pit, and you stop 10 places further.
But that didn't happen after we did the actual record. Like I said, the 1,000 kilometers above 400 and then the top speed.
Yeah.
After that, I drove for a week. I drove everywhere I went under the speed limit just because I'm allowed. Because each time I came back in having only done 480, they said, what's wrong? I said, well, it's that every time I get to that speed, the car's out of control. Well, what do you want? What do you want us to do? And in the end, I was just like, well, I just want to get this over and done with, you know. So finally, when we did the real run and the car started to move around again like this, and I thought, well, if I lift off again, they're just going to make me do it again. So I'm going to stay flat now, no matter what. And one of the reasons where the reason that the car is moving is not really an aerodynamic issue as much as you'd think. It's the fact that the wheels are spinning so fast. The gyroscopic effect of the wheel spinning is overcoming the suspension geometry, the caster angle. So now, if you release the grip, instead of the car going straight, like all cars usually do, this can go anywhere except straight. So let's say the wind is blowing the car slightly to the left and you put a very small input in to come right. It starts to go right, but it keeps going right. And now you need another one to go there, and then another one to go there, and another one to go there. So there's lots of micro movements, and everything's all happening really fast, and you're traveling 140 meters per second. Yeah. So then after that, a whole week, sometimes I had a queue of cars. I could see them in the mirror. They're all like, who's this idiot?
Now we have Max. You're a very important person at the Grand Prix in the Netherlands. Will be this year the last one. How do you feel about it?
Well, I very proud, actually. First of all, that I sort of got that function. So a sporting director is probably the kind of job you can do without school. Like, that's why I got it.
You could also be there.
You're mostly involved with communication, you know, because I live in Zandvoort. I ended up being a racing driver, ended up getting to Formula 1.
You live next to the circuit, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Cool. I'm born about 500 meters away from them.
Born and living still.
Yeah, exactly. So I am a lot of things in Zandvoort, you know, and in the end, I'm just a citizen and blah, blah, blah. But having been in the racing, in the Grand Prix, you know, a few while they were there earlier, I've been on the board of the racetrack for a while. And here is three companies running the Dutch Grand Prix. That's two sports marketing companies, Tick Sports, Sport Vibes. Mm-hmm. And one of the third parties is the Dutch racetrack. So there's a lot of directors, and I'm the sporting
like
director.
Like Belgium,
so,
sort of. Yeah.
No, not at all, because they have a lot of...
They work together.
Well, probably, but they have a lot of government support, and we have zero. Okay.
The thing is, it's the last one.
Yeah.
How do you feel about this?
Well, like I said, very, very proud. Not only proud of being part of that team that brought back that Grand Prix, which many thought, including me, was
including
impossible.
Impossible. It was impossible, but you did it.
You know, everything is impossible until you do it. So
that's
fantastic job.
In business.
Fantastic job. And they made it happen. But then what also is very good and disciplined, and this is where you still had nuchter denk in het Nederlands. You should use common sense also. So we didn't get carried away with our enthusiasm and our passion. But we've had it for 6 years now, including this year.
Yeah.
At least four out of those six times, we have hosted a Dutch world champion with Max.
Fantastic.
You know, sometimes you have to say, like the movie from Jack Nicholson.
You
know,
the highest point. You remember this bigger day?
The movie. The movie was called As Good As It Gets. Great movie, by the way. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes you have to say that's what it is. Yeah. And now I don't think if we would have to continue into another contract, we would have to guarantee four Grand Prix. You know, so that's a lot of money to expect from private investors for the next 4 years.
Yeah.
Where is it going to go? And now the war, you know, horribly in the Middle East, you see how much effect that has on the economy in general. What effect is that going to have on the future of the Dutch Grand Prix in this case? So what is Max going to do? We got this Grand Prix thanks to Max.
Yeah.
With his popularity, we were able to make this a success. Yeah. So I'm perfectly happy that we absolutely took the sweet
good
spot
decision
of the Dutch motorsport with Max. Yeah,
cool.
Congratulations. We did an amazing six years.
I'm a small wheel in the big...
Yeah, but still, you know how it goes. Thanks, guys.
Congratulations also that you had this nice speed.
Oh, thank you very much.
That's great. Great movie.
On the 300 plus. Thank you so much.
Ja, fantastisch. We zijn hier bij de Dutch Dragons. En ik ben hier te gast samen met mijn lieve, dierbare vriend Andy Wallace. We hebben samen de 24 uur van Le Mans gewonnen in 1988. Enorm veel mooie anekdotes en verhalen opgehaald uit het verleden. Maar vooral superleuk om hier samen te zijn. Natuurlijk bij deze geweldige Bugatti-collectie ook voor deze gelegenheid. Dus did you enjoy being here, Andy?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. This is a fantastic place. It was really good fun to be on this podcast. Everywhere you look are really cool things. Cars, pieces of art, furniture, everything. It's fantastic. We had a brilliant afternoon.
Yeah.
We should do it again sometime.
Yeah, nou, wij gaan nog eventjes door met oude verhalen op te halen. Maar jullie kunnen gewoon gaan kijken bij de Dutch Dragons. Dus ik zou het zeker niet missen. Hij is leuk.